The Quarter Pounder with Cheese had many great things. Maple-flavored griddle cakes isn't one of them. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
And my son, who watched a little bit of it with me before leaving, said, "Stop Zooming!" And then he left the room.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
What? What in the hell was that?
That was 10 million pounds of train, Mr. Galvin. And this is the sound of me saving your ass.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 154. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Conductorinos.
And we're also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
No, he is not related to the director of today's big recommend, Tony Scott's Unstoppable. Once again, we'd like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies here on a Tuesday. Appreciate you very much. And let's start off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Jeremy.
Yes, sir.
Take
yes,
us away.
I saw a movie 2 days ago that I had seen the trailer for back in the summer and completely forgot about. For a 2024 movie called Greedy People, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Himesh Patel. There's a lot of people in this. Lily James, Joey Lauren Adams, Simon Rex, Jim Gaffigan, Tim Blake Nelson. I'm going to tell you right now, it's not great, but I had fun with it. It's a 60% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 6.2 on IMDb, and I would call this a wannabe Elmore Leonard type of story. Mm-hmm. Very Elmore Leonard-ish, a little more comedic. But basically, Himesh Patel plays a police officer who moves to an island community called Providence, not the Rhode Island community. But it's a tiny, tiny island town, and he's introduced to his new partner, which is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'm going to tell you the setup, because I don't think you'll even try to watch this if I don't tell you a little bit. And I enjoy Joseph Gordon-Levitt the most in this movie. He's playing completely against his normal type. he's a complete dirtbag. In this movie, and he goes to have sex with his girlfriend because there's no crime in this town. He doesn't really need to do police. And so his new partner, Himesh Patel, ends up responding to a call on his own, shoots his gun at a movement he doesn't expect, and the homeowner woman that he shoots at attacks him for having shot at him, and he kills her in self-defense. This is his first day on the job. So Joseph Gordon-Levitt shows up, and they're freaking out until they find $1 million in cash. And that's all I'm going to say, except that there are a dozen people connected to this caper. Who done it? Who didn't do it? Many of them die in shocking fashion. There's one scene in particular. One character is watching from afar and sees three characters killed in a span of about 10 seconds. And he's smiling because it's so fucking crazy. So yeah, it's one of those movies where I was definitely hooked by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and then I stuck around because I wanted to see where the movie was going to go, and I was ultimately kind of impressed the movie had the balls to go where it went. So there you go.
Okay.
It's on Starz if you'd like to watch it. Yeah, it only made $150,000, so I don't think many people heard of this.
Yeah.
No, I was looking yesterday. I was going to see if I could check it out, but I don't have stars, so I wasn't able to. But it looks interesting. I'll have to see if I can get around to seeing it.
Yeah, I had a good time
on my list.
It's not perfect, but I had a good time with it.
Nice.
Aaron, what do you got for us?
I finally got around to seeing a movie I've been wanting to see for a while, but it just popped up on Netflix recently. And I think it came out into 2023. It is called The First Slam Dunk. This is, first I'll tell you, it has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, 8.1 on IMDb. It is just... For someone who loves the sport of basketball, this is a no-brainer. This movie understands the game of basketball, the sport, better than almost any other basketball movie I've seen this side of Hoosiers. It understands how the team works and understands how the human body looks playing this game at a high level. One of the players, if you're watching the visual element of this podcast, it's the one with the red hair, is so much Dennis Rodman coded, it's ridiculous. Like, you watch him play and you're like, oh, I bet they used reference footage from the way Dennis Rodman plays. And he's kind of like that all out, dive out of bounds, get the rebounds, not necessarily an offensive threat, you know, kind of guy. What it weaves into the amazing basketball are really personal, meaningful, and emotional stories for these players and what they're going through. And the movie has something to say about how sports gives us an opportunity to work out, therapeutically. It's not the first movie to do sports as therapy, but like the things they're going through apply directly to the, whether it be leadership or maintaining their cool or whatever that they have to deal with on the court. Plus the game. The whole movie is a game. It's one game. And then we'll cut away from the game for like backstory, different things like that. I really loved it. I loved it. And I don't think you have to like basketball to enjoy this movie. But man, if you do like basketball, like this, I think it's kind of next level.
So this isn't about the first slam dunk.
No.
This is more like the first for somebody slam dunk or that type of thing.
So... I haven't done a deep dive on this. I think this is a franchise in Japan. I think Slam Dunk is the franchise, and they just called this one like the first Slam Dunk. Even though these movies were like, I think the franchise started in the 90s, and this one came out in 2023. So it's nowhere near the first of this. But like when I was looking up more about this, I saw a lot of other Slam Dunk movies and TV shows and that kind of stuff. So I need to do a little more research, but I will tell you the plot does not revolve around any kind of first slam dunk.
The first ever to do it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I will definitely have to check that out and also do research on it because that's fascinating that it's had multiple movies.
Yeah.
You know, that are like this. And I like a movie that knows its sport because it's so obvious when they don't or they had to cut corners or something like that. So,
yeah.
Last week Gene Hackman died, and that was probably one of my favorite actors of all time. That's not anything that's special to a lot of people, but talk about one that definitely hurts. Gene Hackman dying was one of them. And there's been I've gone off on several Gene Hackman riffs in my time because he's got so many good ones and everything. One of the movies I had not seen of his, it was hard for me to get, but I finally got a Blu-ray of Scarecrow. It came out in 1973. It stars he and Al Pacino as drifters who go on this cross-country thing. Gene Hackman has a lot of big ideas about starting a car wash with Al Pacino. They're strangers at first, but then Pacino sort of wins him over with his humor and everything. But Hackman has this idea, we're going to run a car wash in Pennsylvania. He said, first off, Al Pacino has to go to Detroit, and he has to deliver a present, which you can see in the thumbnail if you are watching this. And got to deliver a present to this kid I've never met and never seen ex-wife or ex-girlfriend or whatever. So there's this whole big plan to go cross-country to do all these different things. And both Hackman and Pacino, they're playing characters that they're not very good at anything, really. They're not, you know, Hackman's got a lot of big ideas, and he's definitely the leader of these two people. Pacino is playing a character I don't think I've ever seen him play before. Like, when you look across his entire filmography, he's always the guy who's the one who's in control, right? He's the one who's the boss in almost everything. He is subservient to Hackman the entire time in this, and Hackman takes advantage of that. So, you know, Hackman is also the one who's like, you know, meeting girls and bedding down girls and everything. Well, Pacino is just kind of like, I'm just here for the ride and whatever. But they're a very mismatched crew. And it's funny listening. If you've looked at stuff about Hackman and Pacino, they look very fondly at this movie because this is some of their best work. I would have to agree with them on this one. Hackman is a little bit different from what we've seen him in most of his very, like, you know, his very well-known roles. Pacino, for certain, this is right after The Godfather for him. This is for Hackman right after French Connection. It's kind of insane how different they are. I mean, it is early in their like career, so it was for back in the day, it was just kind of like, okay, we're doing that acting thing until finally they settled into whatever they went into, whatever they became later. But this movie did not do very well at the box office, but it has, I think, developed sort of a cult following since. And I would highly recommend it if you can find it.
Yeah, I wonder why if they both look at it so fondly, I wonder why it's so hard to find, you know, just kind of one of those that,
yeah,
that got disappeared.
It may not be now.
Oh, okay.
It may not be now. You might be able to find it pretty easily now, but I know that in years past, whenever I would try to find it, I mean, I think you could rent it in certain spots, but like, I think there were times where it was just not streaming or anything. So,
right.
But yeah, I just got the Blu-ray and watched it. But nice. Yeah, that, I think it's just because this is one of the only times where they were able to kind of like play with characters a little bit. And I think they kind of got into personas. They were great personas. This is the reason why we love Pacino and Hackman so much, but they play what would weirdly be against type, even though really they didn't have a type back in 1973. But, you know,
yeah,
I think they look back at it like that. Like, is this something we got to play around with this a little bit? So
it's fun.
Okay. On to our big recommend, which is Unstoppable. And this was Jeremy's pick. So take it away, Jeremy.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
I'm very proud with this pick because in doing research for this episode, I learned that this is one of Christopher Nolan's favorite movies. And one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite
Tarantino
movies.
Loves this movie. He talks about it all the time.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, anybody listening that didn't like it, screw you. I got Nolan and Tarantino in my corner.
Validation.
All right. I've got some sort of allergies going on today. I may need to pause at some point and sneeze or blow my nose. I apologize. But here we go. Unstoppable, inspired by a Soul Asylum song. We open with Hollywood's most dubious phrase, inspired by true events, followed by some glorious signature Tony Scott footage of a train yard. We then cut to shirtless, sleeping Chris Pine in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a city inspired by a real city. We see Pine stalk, watch his kid get sent off to school by his presumable ex, then arrives at the train yard and asks around for Frank Barnes, who will be his partner today, and it's Denzel. He introduces himself as Will Coulson, and it's clear the older workers don't really like the younger ones, and that's inspired by reality. We then get our inciting incident, as Ethan Suplee and TJ Miller fuck around and find out that you should always tie the air brakes between cars and that people are slower than trains. For added drama, there's a train full of school kids on a field trip on hand today as well. Frank tells Will his only real rule is to do the job right, and if you don't know how to do something, ask. Like Frank is some kind of saint himself. Will annoys Frank immediately by taking a personal phone call before they set off. The call reveals to us, the viewer, that Will has some sort of court hearing that has been bumped up to today. And Frank then, shortly thereafter, makes a personal phone call of his own. We then meet Connie, who is Rosario Dawson and is the local yard boss. The Dimwits, that's Ethan Suplee and TJ Miller. I will heretofore refer to them as the Dimwits. Mm-hmm. The Dimwits inform her of their mistake. The first thing they need to fix is getting the school kids' train out of harm's way, so they instruct it to pull into a siding. Connie also calls Ned, a perpetually late employee she knows will be close to another mainline switch that he can throw to divert the runaway train into a siding. We get a little more character development in a brief scene with Frank and Will, where we learn Frank is divorced and his two daughters work at Hooters. That actually, I found, is true. That's one of the few things the movie didn't embellish. The real guy's daughters worked at Hooters. A federal safety inspector, inspired by Leonardo's cousin from The Departed, it's the same actor, shows up to give a presentation to the kids and quickly becomes a valuable source of information for the day's events. Ned reaches and flips the switch, but the dimwits chasing the train show up instead of the train. The train is going faster than anyone realized. The dimwits carry on chasing the train on the tracks in a specialized truck vehicle, while Ned is sent to follow the main line in his truck on the roads and get eyes on the runaway train. The dimwits catch up to the runaway train and attempt a daring maneuver better suited for non-dimwit-type people, as one attempts to almost jump from the truck to the train at high speed, but is unable to do it before they smash into a light. Frank uses a mistake Will makes, putting too many cars on their train to tear into Will's inexperience. He's interrupted, though, with a call about the runaway train that is now headed right for them, and they are instructed to pull the train into the next siding. Now the news has picked up the story about the runaway train and absolutely puts Ethan Suplee's character on blast by showing his photo and saying he's the one employee responsible. Goddamn. I do not think that's how this would be reported. We also meet Kevin Dunn's Galvin character. I love Kevin Dunn so much, as an aside. I'm never, ever anything but happy to see Kevin Dunn show up. He's kind of a CE something of the train company. He's not the muckety-muck highest boss. That guy's golfing, but he's the director of something. He's important. He doesn't want to derail the train, and he's pretty rude to Connie. After a vehicle accident at a crossing, the runaway train plows through an empty horse trailer, demonstrating its raw speed and power. Will and Frank then argue about whether or not their train can fit into the siding, with Will threatening to pull the brake before Frank takes control and speeds up to pass the siding and instead head towards what's called a rip track. In my mind, rip track, siding, for my purposes, same thing. But in the real world, I think they're different things. After a board meeting, the Muckety Mucks decide to go with a Cirque du Soleil maneuver to drop a dangling engineer from a helicopter. At the same time, another engineer will take an engine out in front of the runaway and try and slow it down just by being in front of it and braking. As you might expect, everything goes horribly wrong, and the engineer in the train dies, and the Cirque du Soleil maneuver guy is maimed. It turns out that the engineer was somebody Frank knew, and it's one of the guys that gave Will a rough time in the very beginning when he first arrived at work this morning. Frank then calls his daughters and tells them he loves them, which spooks them and Will. Frank and Will's train gets into the rip track, but the runaway, which is called 777, hits some of the end cars, which Will had accidentally added onto their regular load. The runaway train is not slowed even one bit from the impact. Frank watches as the train passes and notices its rear coupling was open. So he proposes unhooking their cars and chasing the runaway in reverse, coupling it and stopping it with its own momentum. The company plans to derail the train, but Frank insists that will not work. When Connie calls to confirm Frank's suspicions that they are going to derail the train, Galvin is on the line in a group call. Galvin tries to lay down the law and tell Frank to stop his pursuit of 777 or he will fire him. But Frank's got the upper hand here because he's already been given his termination notice. Will hops on to concur with Frank's decision, joke about not caring if he gets fired, and then Frank imitates a static breakup ending their radio signal. That will never not be funny to me, by the way. That's one movie gag that will always get me. Is that acting? Bring it up. As an aside, this is a good time to point out that the helicopters in this movie are constantly flying too close to each other, and it makes me anxious. And when you consider that a lot of the shots of those too close choppers were being shot by a separate helicopter, it's even worse. While they chase 777, Will finally tells Frank and us about his situation. He had come home and found his wife texting someone. She wouldn't say who. He asked to see the phone. She said no, but he grabbed the phone, didn't hit her, but scared her. The movie is intentionally vague about this because it wants you to really like Will. turns out that guy was a cop, and Will went to confront him. The guy claimed they were only friends. Will pulls a gun on him, and honestly, I think Will probably deserves some of the punishment here. He is completely in the wrong and went way over the top. Anyway, the portable derailleur does in fact fail as Frank predicted. And it's worth pointing out that none of the cops and firefighters on the scene had masks or hazmat suits, even though they were intentionally trying to derail a train with known toxic chemicals on it. And earlier in the movie, they even specifically asked for hazmat gear. Anyway, at this point, Frank and Will are the only hope to stave off a huge disaster. The safety expert gets on the mic and explains to Frank that once he couples with the runaway, he needs to alternate acceleration with dynamic braking rather than just gunning it. And it's not the movie's fault, but alternating acceleration with dynamic braking perfectly describes my college sex life. And I'm crying foul on any news station being able to learn about Frank's train and 3 minutes later have an on-screen graphic showing how they intend to catch up with it in these rendered animations and shit. But they do have that, and it's cool, and it helps the audience watching the movie understand. Will volunteers to go out to the back of the engine and use hand signals and radio to help Frank know when and how to couple the thing. The first attempt doesn't work, and the grain car on the runaway train breaks a seal, complicating visibility. The second attempt works, but it's a movie, so it doesn't work completely. It works like 70% of the way, but the pin doesn't fall, they say. So Will has to climb out there and try and use his body to force the pin to fall. Thankfully for his marriage, his estranged wife is now watching all this happen on live television and will forget all about the scary violent shit he did, like threatening a cop with a gun, because he thought she was maybe cheating, but yay, love. Will manages his foot in the process. He dangles precariously between the engine and the tail car of 777, but manages to pull himself back up to the platform where Frank can see him and see he's been injured. Will hobbles back to the engine's cabin. For some reason, a ton of authorities are hanging around on rooftops with binoculars right beside the Stanton Curve, which seems unwise, but I am not one of the authorities. Will thinks of a super secret braking maneuver they could try, so Frank goes outside the train to go apply the brakes on the cars of the runaway train. Handbrakes? I'm not entirely sure. It seems like each car has its own manual braking thing, and he's trying to go to each one of them. It's a lot of stuff happening because we need a shot of someone running on top of a train in this movie, and Tom Cruise wasn't available. Frank's daughters are now watching live news at Hooters and of their dad's daring rescue while all their tables get some of the worst service of their entire lives. They won't get fired once the boss finds out why they ignored their tables for 20 minutes, but their tips are going to be shit. As Frank runs along the trains, applying manual brakes one at a time to each car, the main engine's brakes give out and the train starts accelerating again. Turns out, trains have tons of different braking systems, because even though they lost their brakes, there is still an independent brake. So Frank tells Will to hold on to it until he says go. We've had air brakes, manual brakes, so independent brakes are nothing for us to absorb now as an audience, because we're already conditioned to expect the train to have more brakes than we ever thought possible. In a show of love, Will's estranged wife brings her child to the Stanton Curve so they can either witness Will's triumph together or die of toxic gas fumes together 3 minutes after his failure. After getting through the curve, the train going up on only one set of wheels for several cars, which seems physically questionable as the train is still speeding up at that point, Frank then runs car to car, trying to get to the engine to manually stop the runaway. Ned and his giant red truck, as well as a bunch of cops, are hot on the train's trail because they are trying to rescue Will. Will is able to jump from the engine into the truck bed and miraculously makes it and survives, and I personally find it hard to believe IMDb's claim that Chris Pine did 100% of his own stunts after seeing that jump, but apparently he did. The truck races ahead to the engine, where Will intends to, yes, do what the dimwits at the start of the movie couldn't do, which is jump from a moving truck onto the runaway train engine. He jumps! And if you thought he wouldn't make it, you have not realized what kind of movie you are watching. Frank, from a few cars back, raises his arms in victory. The control room erupts, and Will slows the runaway train. The dimwits celebrate as though they have already forgotten the dead engineer and maimed marine from that first insane rescue Galvin cooked up. Whatever, they're both still getting fired. Will's kid and wife are there to greet him almost immediately because there was apparently no traffic between the Stanton Curve and this place several miles further down the track. And we are led to believe they will reconcile. Hooray for alpha males that falsely accuse their wives of adultery but end up saving small Pennsylvania towns from acid baths. It's implied the company gives Frank his job back, as well as giving both men generous compensation for their rescue. Connie arrives and introduces herself to Frank and Will, and they celebrate their victory. And we fade out with Chopper 23 over and out. And yes, it did feel like there were 23 choppers involved in this train chase. And that is Unstoppable. I've got some other notes I want to make, but I'll let you guys give your two cents first.
Yeah, this movie is really good. I hadn't seen it since it was in theaters, but I really, really enjoyed it then. And I think I in general enjoy Tony Scott movies. He was always very reliable action director, and you know, there were times where he really, really misfired, but for the most part, he keeps the pacing on this very. I mean, it's very good, the pacing on this movie. It's only an hour and a half, and you know, we don't bog it down in a whole bunch of nonsense all the way through. So I've always enjoyed Tony Scott, and the thing about Tarantino loving this movie, I think he just likes Tony Scott. He has always been talking about Tony Scott for a long. I mean, he's got that Top Gun thing that he says in that movie, Sleep With Me, had that whole like dialogue about Top Gun.
Yeah.
And of course, True Romance was directed by Tony Scott. That was Quentin Tarantino's script. And then Tarantino would go on to do Crimson Tide script rewrites and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a long relationship between them. Is there ever any doubt when you see Denzel Washington in a movie that he's going to be the authority figure in the movie? Like anytime, you know, like you believe totally that he has been working in a train yard since 1981.
Yeah.
And it's just because of his confidence every time he speaks. And like you always know that you're in good hands with him. In fact, One of the flaws of this movie is that he makes the Kevin Corrigan character completely worthless. You thought that maybe he would contribute. He was like, oh, this guy's smarter than we think he is. He's not just some like desk jockey guy or whatever. But then like when he gives his advice and everything, Washington's the guy who's like, all right, yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm not really going to follow that. And, you know, it sort of, you know, goes away. So, you know, I kind of hate that for Corrigan's character, but, you know, when you got Washington, what are you going to do? Another thing that I love about this movie. Now, I wish I could double feature this with a real life incident, like real life company or something like that. I would wish I could double feature this with Boeing, or double feature this with, you know, the circumstances around the Challenger disaster, because a lot of times, you know, you have people who are cutting corners. They're saving money to make money. And guess what happens when you save money to make money? You end up causing an issue where you might end up having to pay way more money down the line for not fixing that issue in the first place. And we see this from the very beginning. This is a very plot driven movie where we see, yes, the dimwits at the beginning, Ethan Suplee and TJ Miller, couldn't be more perfectly casted, by the way. these are guys who are, I would imagine, replaced. This is part of the movie's theme. Replaced people who were really good at that job.
Yeah.
And now they've got these younger people in, and you know, all they have to do is move trains every once in a while, but they're sitting in there in the car, probably getting high on and like, you know, just listening to the radio and crap when they're supposed to be doing their jobs. And, you know, and then you get these even in like less dangerous, you see these characters in even like stuff like a movie theater that I work, you know, we worked in movie theaters. You see these guys who are like, oh, it'll be all right, don't worry, I'll do this and that, and you know, it'll be totally fine. Like, that's not the point that it'll be fine. The point is there is a chance of something really bad happening if you don't do the thing that you're, and in this case, lives are actually in danger because Ethan Suplee decides, I'm going to drive this train without air brakes, this huge train with tremendous momentum, if it gets away from me. We don't need the air brakes. Oh, and oh, don't worry about this. I can just get out of the train and make the track switch and then get back on the train. Don't worry about that. And we get this theme all the way through it where, like, you see that this company is just cutting and cutting and, like, getting younger in and no experience. Like, The very first time we see Chris Pine's character, we are told the truth there. That's not like some underdog thing where his name is the reason why he is even in this position in the first place. He got a union job without even really doing much of the work. He trained, sure, but like not to the, he doesn't have any experience whatsoever, and he's taking the place of people who do. And when you're looking down at like profit margins and stuff like that, and it just feels like any rando can do this job because you're just sitting in an office, or in this case, the big ones are playing golf. That's not an accident that they show them playing golf right. When they get the call. That, you know, they're not really doing any work at all. They don't even probably know anything about the industry that they're they're ahead of, you know. They know enough to where they make the money, but that's it. But yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't know if you ever saw that documentary on Boeing where they used to be the gold standard for any kind of, you know, for any kind of business. And they didn't cheap out on safety or anything like that. They didn't cheap out on, they made sure everything was right about that product. And then when they got sold, everything was about profit at that point. And just like that, we don't need safety inspectors, this many safety inspectors, or this many this or that or whatever. And guess what? Boeing has now got a shit reputation. Like, it's, you know, that's what happens with that type
of thing. Now we're operating a whole country under this kind of ideology.
Yes, we are, Jeremy. Yes, we are.
But also, I wanted to point out before you change topics, that you and I watched this kind of thing happen when we went to Regal in 99, mm-hmm. because Hollywood 27 mostly employed union projectionists at that time. And Chris and I were among the first manager operators that they started rolling into the booth. This was all because Regal wanted to stop paying rising union wages mm-hmm. and stop bargaining with them. And managers are salaried employees that you just give raises whenever you feel like it. They don't have a union. And little by little, Regal and probably the other chains drove union projectionists almost completely out of the business.
Yeah. And this was a horrible situation to be put in when you need a job too. So like now you have to compete with the fact that, yeah, it's probably better to have union projectionists running your projectors. But at the same time, I want a job too. And right. like, you know, they're like, this is a conflict that I didn't want to have, guys. You know, like I was immediately going. And then in New York, I had the same issue because they were putting in digital projectors and all that. And there was a worry with the company that there might be a situation where the union projectionist would be gone, but there would still be they needed to run some 35 millimeter until digital got in. So there was like this chaos of like having to train all these people who've never worked on this stuff. And definitely the quality is going to go down. Yep. Sorry, all these union projectionists, that's what they trained on, and they like know the ins and outs of it, man. They're like technicians on these things. We were like people like me, I was good at running the movies and making sure they were good, but I couldn't open up a projector and do all this stuff if it needed to be fixed. So the thing that I was going to say here is that Tony Scott does annoy me in a few instances in this movie. There's some moments where he just can't stop the camera from moving. And he just keeps it's there. I think we get the point that the scene is exciting and that it's tense and all that, but we don't need every single shot to be one of these like goes around the character as they speak type of thing. This is actually something that you see in a lot of amateur hour type of things where like people are like, we're going to make this look exciting. So we're going to have this rotating shot going around and around and around and all that. And like, he doesn't do that to that level too much, but like the camera moving on just somebody talking happens so often in this. And I'm like, just a little bit notched down, please. We don't need it every single shot, man. And also, I think the people who are dumb in this movie are way too dumb at times. The cops who shoot at the train trying to get the brakes, like they're trying to hit this tiny little button. And of course the news story is like, this is how dumb this is. They're trying to shoot this little button that's right next to something that could explode. And you're just like, yeah, I imagine this probably does happen. You know, whatever. There's probably like dumb decisions being made, but man, the way these people talk and everything, it's like, it feels like an alternate reality, even though yes, people are this dumb and blah, blah, blah. But my God, man, it felt like, are we really on this thing where there's only three smart people in the movie and like everybody else is dumb? That's where I was like, come on, man, let's tone some of that down. In the end, doesn't ruin it for me, but like, I love the movie, and that's something that I wish he could have just toned down a little bit.
Sure. It's like I've come so far around on Babylon that I truly think I love it now, except for the overuse of the whip pans. Like what he did once in La La Land, he does 52 times in Babylon.
Yeah, he likes it
too much.
Right.
Well, Chris, you just basically went down my list of notes. So I'm going to rehash. I'm going to rehash a couple things here. Number one, this movie is so fun to watch. It is a blast to watch. But I guess I'll start where you finished, just because it's fresh. It very much feels Michael Bay adjacent the way Tony Scott, you know, shoots this movie with all the movement. And my son, who watched a little bit of it with me before leaving, said, "Stop zooming," and then he left the room. So it's like, yeah, there's a lot of those quick zooms in and out of, like, you know, normal stuff that's just happening. And again, I get it, totally get that we're, you know, this is attention kind of thing, but it does stand out. It's one of those things that if you notice it, you can't unnotice it. Like the camera's just always doing that stuff. I think it is. I was trying to think what the second. What was the very last point you made?
People were stupid.
Oh yeah, yeah. The defense of, like, you know, the stupid decisions that people are making. The movie is so concerned about making us think highly of its primary characters that it just makes everybody else seem stupid. And honestly, like, in the real situation, they made decisions to do things, you know, that didn't work, but they probably did them with a little more thought than just lining up 10 police officers with shotguns to try
That's
to hit
what
a moving,
I feel like.
You know, like,
It happened, but did it happen that way?
Exactly. Really? No. And I'm even watching it going, you know what? Putting another train in front of it and then slowing it down and having somebody try to board from the air, that's not a terrible idea, but the movie wants it to feel like the stupidest idea ever. And so, you know, it paints it in a certain way. So yeah, there are those things. It's also News Position the movie. I mean, it is all the information, and it makes sense because clearly something like this would be on the news. But all the information we get is from, it's, and Jeremy, you mentioned it as well. But
it's,
yeah,
interesting on that note, though. IMDb says, like, he went out of his way to use real news people from Ohio and Pennsylvania to do all the news deliveries because he knew there was so much of it in the movie. He wanted it to feel as authentic as possible. So
a couple smaller notes. It is sad to me as an old man to watch a movie like this and see camcorders and realize how outdated that looks for somebody to be shooting something with a camcorder. Like, everybody holds phones now, but like, there are these shots in the movies, everybody's got like their camcorder. I'm like, oh my goodness, that's like, that's ancient history now. Like, that is ancient history to actually carry around like a dedicated video camera.
Like 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy how fast that changes. It's so dated now. But I think this movie succeeds primarily on the chemistry between Denzel and Chris Pine. I think that in the clever writing, there's so many fun moments from beginning to end between them. The camaraderie they develop through the movie. I think the linchpin scene of that. I don't actually literally mean the linchpin scene that is in the movie with the trains. I mean the linchpin of that thing with them is the moment where Denzel first says, "You already fired me," which is a great, great scene. And then Chris Pine jumps on with him and is like, "Oh, it's too bad. I was really starting to like this job," or whatever he says there. That's where that connects. And then from then on, it's just like they are on the same page trying to do this thing together. I think it's great all the way to the end where it's like, you know, which one of you do I kiss first? And Denzel's like, "Oh, that would be me." Like all that stuff is just really fun. And I just love it. It's a good hang. This movie's a good hang. It's fun to watch. It is exciting. So yeah, I had a good time with it.
Speaking of that kiss, IMDb says, if you watch that scene, Rosario Dawson kisses Denzel on the cheek and then backs away and gives like this smile of awe, because she just was caught up in the moment and couldn't believe she was kissing Denzel, and she wanted to do another take, but Tony Scott really liked it and kept it in the movie. She was embarrassed by the fact that she had gotten so giddy at kissing Denzel's cheek.
I noticed that. There was a genuine reaction. It almost made me feel like maybe it was improvised. I don't think it was, but that moment just felt so real. I guess I also wanted to say I'm an Ethan Suplee guy. I loved him in My Name Is Earl and have just been following him. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know this about him, he's like jacked now. Like he got in like, you know, super shape and like does weightlifting.
I made a Babylon reference because he's in that movie.
Is he?
Isn't he the jacked bodyguard of Tobey Maguire?
Maybe
go underground to see.
Could
the guy
could
that
be.
Connects?
I would have to look. I don't remember him being that. But
all right.
But anyways, yeah, he it was kind of fun a few years back to see him just kind of make the decision just to go after his health in that way. And you know, I always find those things kind of fun. So,
yeah, he's in Babylon. Yeah. He's the jack bodyguard of Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, there you go.
He's had a long career, man. He's been around forever.
Yeah,
simply like
he was
like
kind of a child actor, wasn't he? Like he grew up acting.
Don't remember if he did child acting, but I think the first time I can actually remember seeing him was in Mallrats, because he was the guy trying to do the magic eye thing, and he couldn't do the magic eye. And then he's in American History X as just an awful racist guy, but like he's great in that movie. But yeah, he's had a long hit, but he has over 100 and something credits.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite that guys. You know, like you just see him and you're just like, "Oh, it's that guy." So yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You were gonna say something, Jeremy?
Sure.
No, I didn't know. I thought you were about to say something.
I was gonna say he's in Remember the Titans, right?
Yes. Yeah. Denzel. With Denzel.
Yeah. He's had a good career. I like that guy. I also wanted to point out, because I don't think any of us has said it yet, that really is Denzel running on top of that train.
Really?
They put him in a wire harness, but Tony Scott couldn't believe he got him to do it because apparently Denzel is afraid of heights. And I love learning humanizing things like that about A-list stars. Like Denzel Washington, of all people, shares my fear of heights. But they actually got him up on that train to do that stunt. I thought that was pretty awesome.
And after reading the chat, like apparently that fuel line thing was as dumb as it was in the movie. So,
well, there you go.
I'm just saying it feels like everybody is that dumb. Like everybody is that dumb in the movie. There's nobody else smart except Denzel and maybe Rosario Dawson.
I had the same feeling.
You know, so it feels weird when they can't teamwork this one together. It's got to be Denzel, like, "I got to use my experience." And then it's you know, and of course, that's what saves the day. And Chris Pine is able to do some things with his youth and all of that. But anyway, so yeah, apparently it was that dumb, and people are that dumb. And I'm sorry I ever mentioned it. let's see. Let's go on to our super secret double feature.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right, I'll start us off here. I was trying to come up with an unconventional one, something that was kind of like, you know, corporate cutting corners type of thing. There's a lot of those type of movies. In the end, I think I'm going to go with an easy one here. There are actually two really easy ones, but I'll go with just one and not say anything else beyond that. But the remake of Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 with Tony Scott directing and Denzel Washington, that's back-to-back train movies. Obviously, the train isn't really the biggest drama of the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. It's not nearly as good as the original either, but I think it's a really good double feature with these two, and they actually came out back-to-back, too. Taking of Pelham came out in 2009, Unstoppable in 2010. So I think that's a good one. I have some other ones, but I'm going to let Aaron go with his.
Well, I thought there were two obvious ones, and I took the other obvious one. I also thought of Taking of Pelham as one, and then I went with Speed, which I think is the other no-brainer. Speed just feels like a cousin to this movie. Like, it just, like, two people trying to figure it out together, you know, trying to stop a runaway vehicle. In one case, they just need to stop it. In the other case, they can't stop it. So it's kind of the inverse a little bit, but yeah, you know, and helicopters and all sorts of things. So there you go.
Yeah, that's such an apropos double feature that I have a friend of mine who calls Unstoppable Speed Train as well. Mm-hmm. So yes. I see a couple in there. The 1970 Airport. Apollo 13 is a good one, I think. The only thing about Apollo 13 that I would say is so dramatically different from this is that, like, there's smart people doing a team job on Apollo 13, whereas this one just feels like it's the heroes who are there, the Denzels of the world are the only ones who can save this. Mm-hmm. And Apollo 13's failures didn't happen because people were being stupid at their job or anything like that. It was something that they just didn't realize at the time. Stuff that happened with the spacecraft and everything, whereas this was just because somebody was a dumbass at their job and just wanted to be lazy and everything. So
The others that I considered were Deepwater Horizon feels a lot like this movie, and then I briefly considered Bullet Train as well. As a double feature with this.
Deepwater Horizon definitely has that corporate people forcing things that creates a disaster.
Yeah.
Good call.
Okay. What is next week's homework? Aaron's pick this time. So what are we going to do this time, Aaron?
All right. So I've been trying to math my way to my choices, trying to find similarities between the two movies you picked. I'm picking another one. So this time we're going with making stupid decisions that hurtle you towards possible danger with The Informant and Unstoppable. And so my choice in that category is Jurassic Park.
Look at this.
It's a classic. This is one of the greatest movies ever made, and it's I'm excited to get into the details.
And yet, movies like this that point out the flaws in Rotten Tomatoes, because this is a 91 on Rotten Tomatoes because of the way they go back on old movies before Rotten Tomatoes existed.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know exactly how they calculate those, but if Jurassic Park came out today, it would be a 99 or 100. Like, it's one of the greatest movies ever made. I saw the 91 when I pulled it up and I was like, what the hell?
Yeah. And you know, and this would be like a decent double feature with Unstoppable.
Right? Yeah.
A lot of corporate decisions being made there where, like, you know, let's cut some corners. What's the harm that could happen? We're cutting some corners who we hire and what we're going to do about keeping them fenced in and all of that, you know? So, yeah, it totally makes
Go ahead.
Good.
I was going to say, I watched this last week, and if I'd known you were going to pick it, I would have taken notes, but now I have to watch it again, so thanks.
You're welcome.
I have not seen this in a long time, but this is, I've seen it probably a good 20 times over the years, and this was an early one, early movie theater movie for me. I started when Last Action Hero opened the week before Jurassic Park opened. And so I got to see a lot of that, that movie's box office craziness happen right before my eyes. So it's a sentimental one for me as well. So can't wait to look back at Jurassic Park. All right, looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
And let's see what we got here in the old mailbag. In the movie There Will Be Blood, one of my favorite scenes is the oil rig fire. Besides being shot and scored beautifully, the scene is in the entire movie in one scene. The son is losing his hearing, Daniel only cares about money and power, and Eli knows Daniel isn't going anywhere. What other movies have the entire plot in one scene? Jeremy.
All right. Well, my notes, I replied to this. I answered these questions after you guys. So I said, you guys took the best answers, damn it. But I'll go with, I think, Spider-Man Homecoming, after he has the fight with Vulture in that warehouse and is under that pile of rubble and has to basically decide if he's going to continue trying to be a hero. And he has to will himself out of that pile of rubble. And he does. It's a great scene in and of itself, but I think it sort of encapsulates his journey for the whole movie. So that was my answer.
I think it's a good one.
I picked the Roma ice cream scene. Now, Roma is one of those movies where you could actually probably pick several scenes for this because the whole movie does such a great job of encapsulating what it's about and its themes in almost every frame. And in this case, we're dealing, you know, with humans in the foreground and background having completely opposite experiences, joy and pain. The pain is trying to, salve with, you know, finding joy in the ice cream. And then there's also like a dog pooping, you know, over, you know, in a corner somewhere too. Like that is Roma, is just like this humanity, this life, this messiness, this grossness, this beauty all exists in the same place. And I think that scene encapsulates it really, really well. So, yeah.
That's another one I need to take a look at again at some point, because that is a good scene. I remember being kind of underwhelmed with Roma. I know that you guys had it as your top movie of that year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I need to watch it again.
Spielberg screwed it.
I don't know if this is a stretch or not to come, you know, when looking at the way this question is worded, but in Jackie Brown, Robert Forster, looking at the full plan taking place in front of him during the trial run, he's skeptical that the plan will work until he sees it play out before his eyes, and we see a concerned look turn into a half smile by the end. It's something that I love that Tarantino does here, because we're following his eyes for the most part during that entire scene. And when the camera pulls back, we see that he's gone from concern to kind of like, whoa, Jackie has planned this out really well. But of course, you know, the whole reason why he even entertains the idea in the first place is because he's in love with Jackie, which is another fun thing about that scene. So I do think that a lot of the movie is told during that trial run, because we learn how the plan works. We learn what Jackie's doing. We know that Robert Forster's in love with her and everything. So that's what I picked on.
You
that.
Brought us back to Elmore Leonard.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Looks like we have time for at least one more here. Let's see. What's the best song in a musical sung by an actor in the scene with a song made for the story, not just some pop song snuck in? I am a sucker for Moulin Rouge, especially a sucker for Come What May, especially when they sing it at the end of the movie. There, you know, a lot of like real nitpickers out there Didn't like how Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman sang in Moulin Rouge, but I really enjoy how they sing in that movie. And I'm glad that it's not super professional. I'm glad that they're so there's, and it's still good. It's not like, you know, it's not bad. I don't think it's bad anyway. No. I love Come What May in Moulin Rouge.
I'm glad you said that. Cause that movie, I love that song from that. Like I would play that song every day after seeing that movie for the first time. I think it's phenomenal.
The first half of Moulin Rouge is one of my favorite movies. It's just my way of saying then, the second half
you didn't like kind the of second
kills my enjoyment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I will. I'm going to go with Emma Stone singing Audition, Fools Who Dream in La La Land. I think there's... It's not just the performance, which I think is great. And again, there's some similar thing in La La Land with people being like, oh, Ryan and Emma weren't, you know, perfect singers or dancers. And it's like, yeah, but they are perfect actors. And that helps a lot. But Emma is so good in that scene. And it means so much to the story and so much to the movie, what's going on there about her understanding where her priorities are, what her dreams are, what it means, you know, to her to pursue that. So yeah, that's probably my favorite.
Wow. So I think I'm agreeing with the chat. Maybe I don't remember the name of the song, but the Anne Hathaway, I think, overdid her Oscar acceptance speech just a little bit, but she did slay that song in Les Mis, which I had to watch. We send Les Mis early. I watched that movie
long time
six
ago.
Damn times when we were making the script for that. And I don't like that movie. But she's outstanding in that scene, and I think deserving of the Oscar. So that was my answer.
Going over to the chat on the last two questions, going back to the first question about what scene basically tells the whole movie, Kashrif says, the opening closing scenes of Memento, that's really good. Nolan says, in My Neighbor Totoro, the screen with the umbrella and raindrops. Yes. Kasher says, also Cobb letting go of his wife's memory in Inception. Nolan says, also the climax of Parasite, the birthday party is just so beautifully layered like that cake. In going into the song portion, actually, there was another one on the scene thing. The presentation scene in Jurassic Park where they get lap bars in the movie theater, but then they just break out of them. That's also a thing that they
That's
do.
A great call.
It's a great one. It's also the thing that a lot of people pointed out about the helicopter scene where Sam Neill takes two female ends of his seatbelt to tie the
belt
together. To find a way. So yeah, it's some pretty clever crap going on in Jurassic Park, which we will do next week. The songs, Castro says Chicago, they both reach for the gun. Yeah. And I love that number so much. I love how they staged that and everything. It's so good. James says not a musical, but Charlie Chaplin's Gibberish Song in Modern Times is a fun one. And I don't think it has to be a musical. I think the question just says pick a song that they sing in the movie. Nolan says, "You're such a loser, Dad," sung by Billy Bean's daughter in Moneyball.
That's a great choice.
That's a really good one.
Actually. Love that.
Yes. Flyboy says, "On My Own" from Les Mis. And then I think Nolan says, "The Show" is the name of the song actually in the Billy Bean thing. I think is called "The Show" is what you're saying. Let's see, Rick Moranis singing Feed Me, Get It in Little Shop of Horrors. Some good ones there from chat. I'm glad we could get back to questions. It's been a while.
Nobody wanted to bring up Blame Canada or anything from, you know.
Oh, Blame Canada. That's a good one.
It's an appropriate song for conversations
going on.
It
took
us
26 years to see it play out in real life.
That's right. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us today. We appreciate you very much. Next week is Jurassic Park. Can't wait to deep dive that one. Haven't really ever deep dove it before, so I'm looking forward to that. But that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See
Bye,
you,
guys.
Everybody. Bye. a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
I didn't have a meet cute today. I had a meet angry today.
Meet angry.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that like driving angry?
It was the closest situation I've ever had to somebody experiencing road rage with me. But it was drive through rage. And so I had to take something to my wife. My wife forgot her badge today, and so I had to run that into town. I was like, I'm gonna grab my favorite breakfast burrito of all time while I'm here, since I'm in town, which is the Chick-fil-A breakfast burrito that has chicken in it. It's a chicken breakfast burrito. It's one of the most incredible things I've ever had. Anyway, so I grabbed one of those, go through the drive-thru, and I'm pulling through. I'm following the car in front of me. Well, I'm at that point where you're just beyond the, you know, talky-talky thing where you do your order. And another guy pulls in to the second lane, comes around, and then when the line moves, like, darts in front of me, and I'm already moving, and I was afraid he was gonna like hit me. Like, I'm continuing to follow the car, and he's like, nope, my turn, and just kind of zooms in. So I honked my horn, just a little bit of like, hey, beep, you know, like I'm, you know, trying to get in here. And he kept going, so I, you know, hit my brakes, let him. He almost had to climb the curb, like, to go around me.
Oh, geez.
And get in line. So he gets in line. Go ahead, Chris, what were you gonna say?
Well, it's just such an easy thing. I mean, the two drive-through thing is an easy thing to figure out. Like, they go to alternate ones when they do the thing. So, like, you hear that person over there gets done, you're behind that person. Or they'll tell you, be behind the car that just came, like the white Corolla or whatever. You know, they always do that. But yet there's still people out there who are like, nah, it's all for me. I'm going to be the first, you know.
So this is all wonderful stuff that you're saying, because it plays into what happens next. What happens next is after he pulls in front of me, the line stops a little bit. He puts it in park. He gets out of his vehicle and comes to my window. Now, Jesus I'm faced Christ. With a choice here. Right? Like, do I just wave him back to his car? Do I just, you know, crack my window and just hear what he has to say? I'm too curious. I want to know what this person is going to say to me. He didn't look extremely, he looked like a kid. Like, he was probably, of course, everybody looks like a kid to me. Honestly, I'm old now. Like, you know, 30-year-olds look like children to me. I don't understand how this works. But I cracked my window, and he looks at me and he goes, you know, at Chick-fil-A, they alternate the lanes. And I'm going, and I think I said, well, they told me to follow, this is what you said, they told me to follow the car ahead of me because you weren't here yet when I got through. Like, you came in after me, so I was already following this car, and then he just, like, slammed his, you know, foot against the ground and turned around. Yeah, and he was like, you know, it'll be effing over in a second anyway. Like, you know, he's all upset. And I was
he realizes he's wrong now, but that now it's something else that he's going to say is the problem, you know?
So I was glad he went back to his vehicle and we all got our food, but it was funny because we got up to the window and I saw the person try to give him my food. And he was like, actually, not that one. And they had to find his food because I was next. It was supposed to be me. Validation.
Yeah. I had something. It was a different kind of drive-through incident. I was at a Taco Bell. It was late at night, and the car in front of me was sitting there at the thing. Now, I don't honk my horn. I know that there's a lot of times where the people inside are not getting to the person yet, and I haven't heard anybody talking or anything like that.
Right.
So I'm assuming there's a holdup or whatever. So I'm just sitting back, just being patient and everything. And then, like, somewhere in the distance, I hear a car horn. It was like in the parking lot. It was way away from us in the drive-thru or whatever. And the guy in the car in front of me thought I honked at him.
Oh, no.
And he got out of his car much like that, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
And he was like, did you just honk at me? And I was like, no, it was a honk that was over in the parking lot. And he's like, oh, okay. Because I was about to say, and like, there's nothing like someone taking an incident that is there. I'm not in the wrong. And then saying, mm-hmm. I was about to say, that makes an incident almost a fight for no reason. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm like, you were going to say what, motherfucker?
Because and honking the horn is, mm-hmm. it's such an ineloquent way to communicate with other drivers, you know, like I try to, like in the case this morning, I honked because I wanted him to know he was about to hit me. Like, you know, I didn't, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't want to get in an accident. And that's generally how I try to use it. I don't usually try to use it to communicate because all it communicates is whatever the other person interprets, which is, you know, usually a middle finger. You know, that's what most people think a horn means.
I mean, unless you're in New York City, downtown Chicago, when every car honks at every other car.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they're pretty meaningless. I remember when I moved to New York, I was like, man, people honk their horns about everything here. It's like, yep, they're just kind of letting you know that they're there.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.